what? It's crying, and we need to understand that she is an alive being, that she's our mother, that she nurtures. And we need to stop these types of TPP or any type of agreement, really. We need to move beyond this type of economy. We don't need this, not anymore. This is not sustainable, and we can do better, for sure.
Right.
And I believe that we will win because we love life more than anybody else. Thank you.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Today, the election is over. Donald Trump has been elected as the 45th president of the United States, and activists are heading to the streets. We'll be speaking with Margaret Flowers, one of the organizers of 4 days of action starting tomorrow, November 12th, here in D.C., against the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, which it is believed President Obama will try to push through Congress in the lame duck session. Also, as the so-called alt-right has scored a victory with the election of Donald Trump as president, activists are once again protesting the presence of the right-wing organization, the National Policy Institute, holding a white supremacist convention right here in D.C. in the federal Ronald Reagan building next week. So we have a lot packed into this hour, and we'll get started with our headlines. Tens of thousands of demonstrators have taken to the streets around the country for 2 nights in a row, protesting the election of Donald Trump. Those protests continued in the DMV last night. In Baltimore, hundreds of demonstrators rallied throughout the downtown area, including outside the M&T Bank Stadium, where the Baltimore Ravens were playing the Cleveland Browns in Thursday night football.
Black lives, they matter here. No to Trump and no to fear. Black lives, they matter here. No to Trump and no to fear.
Black lives, they matter here.
No to Trump and no to fear.
Black lives, they matter here.
No to Trump and no to fear.
At the White House Thursday night, hundreds gathered under the theme, Not My President. Students Bridget Melody and Kia Washington said that they were heckled by pro-Trump supporters, but plan to attend more demonstrations.
We live in the perfect place for it. There's a protest coming Saturday, so we're definitely attending that.
I might call out of work to go to that if it's during my work hours. That's how serious this is. This isn't a joke to me anymore.
I skipped class for this.
The Institute for Policy Studies also held a meeting for progressives to chart a path forward. Chantel James has more.
It was a packed room as a crowd in mourning for the recent presidential election gathered this Wednesday. The event was held at the Institute for Policy Studies and was dubbed Election Debrief, Next Steps for the Progressive Movement. Panelists were Steve Cobble of the IPS, Alan Barber of CEPR, Jonathan Hutto of Prince George's County, Maryland People's Coalition, Flavia Jimenez of the Advancement Project, and Phyllis Bennis of IPS. And the panel was moderated by John Kavanaugh of IPS. Panelists stressed the need to unite at this critical time. Jonathan Hutto brings us back to the words of Stokely Carmichael.
What I want to say to any activist, any organizer, anyone that desires to labor for peace, that should be all of us, is that if we left the streets, we got to get back in the streets and organize for our survival.
The event was video streamed live on the web, and people who are not in attendance submitted questions to the panelists via social media. To keep up with what the Institute for Policy Studies is doing, follow them on Twitter at IPS_DC. For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
Well, now to weigh in on the election is the author and historian Gerald Horn, whose most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as a Revolutionary. I also say that he is a frequent contributor to this show and across the Pacifica Network. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
Well, I guess if I could summarize the postscripts on the election that I've heard that I respect, I would say that the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, and Hillary Clinton lost the election, but the DNC and many of their spokespersons are blaming everybody else. What's your postscript on the election?
Well, certainly Hillary Rodham Clinton has a case to answer. She did not visit Wisconsin one time during this campaign. I think part of the lesson of this election is that voter suppression works. One of the reasons she did not do as well in Wisconsin as she suspected she would is because of voter ID. It seemed to me there should have been a massive effort to ensure that potential Clinton voters had ID. And in any case, if you look over the last 25 years, it's fair to say that Bill Clinton, supported by Hillary Clinton, locked up many of his potential voters. That is to say, the crime bill of the 1990s led to a mass incarceration of black men in particular. And then when they left prison, oftentimes they had a felony conviction around their neck, which meant that they were deprived of voting rights. And so in many cases, she was the author of her own misfortune. But I think it's also fair to say that not only Hillary Rodham Clinton, but many on the left in general, historically have underestimated right-wing sentiments in the white community. I still find it stunning, according to exit polls, that 53% of white women voted against Hillary Rodham Clinton. That is to say, they voted for a confessed sexual predator. Now, this should not be unusual. Routinely, the Republicans win the white women vote. But I think it's now past time for us to have an honest assessment. And it may lead to personnel changes at the top of the National Organization for Women. And speaking of personnel changes, we may want to consider the same at the AFL-CIO. To an extent, it's overblown that the working class helped to propel Donald J. Trump to the presidency. Although it is fair to say that a good deal of the white working class did propel him to the presidency. And the head of the AFL-CIO, Rich Trumka, comes from the miners' union. The miners' union have quite a bit of weight in West Virginia, and West Virginia has been voting for Republicans routinely for oh so many years now. Indeed, the senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, who is a Democrat, apparently is considering caucusing with the Republicans so that he can get a committee chairship. And so we need a lot of explanation. We need a few personnel changes. But most of all, I think we need an agonizing reappraisal of the last 240 years of U.S. history. And when we do so, we will find that the counter-revolutionary impulse has been central to the formation of this country. The difference now is that routinely the U.S. ruling class, which is mostly white, is in favor of counter-revolution abroad. They profited handsomely from that. Now the base of the Republican Party, which is mostly white working class and middle class, are saying they want a counter-revolution at home, and that spells ill for black people, that spells ill for brown people, that spells ill for all people of goodwill.
So in addition to the voter suppression in Wisconsin, there was voter suppression in many states, and it just occurred to me that why didn't the Democratic Party come to the defense of disenfranchised voters just like they did? You know, they also didn't come to the defense of Florida voters in 2000. Is this because they didn't want to legitimize, you know, Donald Trump's claims that the election was rigged, or what are your thoughts?
Well, I think you should interview some of these DNC leaders and see what they have to say. But obviously, they dropped the ball. I mean, it's apparent that voter suppression works with this new Republican-controlled Congress, with the prospect of a new Supreme Court justice who is conservative, with the fact that the Republicans now have a stranglehold over state capitals from the Atlantic to the Pacific. You can expect more voter suppression measures because voter suppression basically works. Speaking of the deficits of Hillary Rodham Clinton, I also think that her foreign policy didn't make much sense. That is to say, particularly with regard to confronting Russia, not least in Syria, with regard to this so-called safe zone and no-fly zone, which could have precipitated World War III, it also only helped to whip up right-wing sentiment that then served as a backlash against her candidacy. I think that we need an inventory from top to bottom, not only of why and how this election was lost, but also, once again, personnel changes. We just can't have generals losing wars and continuing to keep their jobs.
So, according to reports in Mother Jones and Rolling Stone, there was this documented voter suppression, and we talked about that. But I'm wondering what's next. in terms of this Trump investigation. He's under investigation, and I don't know if we've ever had a president-elect under investigation, like going into office.
Well, I think it may be possible for his lawyers to manipulate the law and to say that it would be a violation of the separation of powers for a president to be facing cross-examination on the witness stand while he has a chair in the Oval Office. In fact, if you look at the case about Trump University in Washington and the case unfolding in California as we speak, Daniel Petrocelli who is his lawyer, that was the argument that he basically made to Judge Curiel, the judge who, of course, Trump denounced because of his Mexican origin. So he may be able to suspend many of the cases that he faces. On the other hand, I think one of the more telling stories of the post-Tuesday election result is the fact that the stock of Corrections Corporation of America, which, of course, builds private prisons and will be building immigration detention centers, the euphemistic designation that we use in this country, their stock went through the roof.
Right.
And I think one of the early positions and one of the early actions of the Trump administration in January 2017 will be a massive roundup of undocumented immigrants and a massive deportation, massive detentions. And I think that one of the lessons going forward is a lesson we should have imbibed years ago, which is that we need to send delegations immediately to Mexico City to align with our friends across the border to help build a strong trans-border alliance. I also think we should take advantage of the fact that China, which is also in the crosshairs, will probably be building one of the largest embassies on planet Earth in Mexico City. And I think that the lesson is that because of the negative correlation of forces in the United States, because of the fact that you have this counter-revolutionary impulse that courses throughout white America, we need to lengthen the battlefield. And we need to lengthen the battlefield by building alliances abroad across the border in Mexico in the first place.
Okay, well, I've been speaking to Gerald Horn, author and historian, and a frequent contributor to this show. I very much appreciate it. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
In culture and media, We Act Radio here in D.C. is celebrating its fifth anniversary this weekend. Congratulations to Kimon Freeman and all the broadcasters at We Act for creating progressive content. Starting tomorrow, there will be 4 days of action, as I mentioned, to protest the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, and we'll talk to organizers about that later in the show. On Tuesday, there will be a global day of solidarity with the people of Standing Rock to tell President Obama to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline, and that will be at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer headquarters, 441 G Street Northwest. That's this Tuesday, November 15th at 5 p.m., Or the organizers say the movement to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline is growing stronger by the day, and it's time for all of us to rise up and play a role in this fight. And that's Tuesday, November 15th at 5 p.m. at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer headquarters, 441 G Street in Northwest D.C. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, activists say it's time to finish off the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty. Stay with us. That was a Funky President remix by DJ Waheed on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Avarum, and for this segment, I'm speaking with the co-directors of Popular Resistance, an organization for social justice activism and news, Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers. And Margaret Flowers was also a Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate from Maryland. Thank you for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So I always feel like we have to kind of go back and just tell people what the TPP is and what the status is right now.
The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is an agreement with U.S., some Latin American and Asian nations that would really be a shift in power to transnational global corporations, making them more powerful in governance. It's called a trade agreement, but it's really more about giving power to corporations to act all over the world with impunity. It gives them the power to sue governments when they put laws in place for the public interest to protect people and planet. They could be sued in a trade tribunal controlled by the World Trade Organization, and countries could be fined if they are passing laws that undermine corporate profits. And so it's a very dangerous, covers many aspects of our life. As far as the status goes, it has been signed by the various countries. We're at the last stage, which is ratification. Japan's made some progress on ratification, but no country has ratified it yet. They're all waiting for the United States. President Obama continues to push for ratification, even though the leaders of both houses, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, have said the votes aren't there. And with the election of Donald Trump, they're all saying this is up to Donald Trump. We should hold off until he becomes president. Donald Trump, of course, opposes the TPP. He opposes NAFTA. And so things are really unraveling right now on the trade front. We're about to go into next week with a major series of protests that will hopefully put the nail in the coffin for the TPP. In the lame duck, which may mean it's finished, not just in the lame duck, but forever.
If I could just add quickly, some of the ways that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would impact people's daily lives is that it will drive a race to the bottom in wages. It will create more jobs going out of the country. It will impact our food safety, lowering the standards for that. It will raise the price of medications. It will impact our freedom of using the internet. So these are just a few of the many ways that it will hurt us. It will also make it impossible for us to take the necessary steps to deal with the climate crisis. So it's critical that we stop this, and we're in a strong position now, but it's not dead yet. And so it's important that we rise up now and stop it.
You know, during the presidential election, and, you know, the term proto-fascism or fascism was often used to describe the candidacy, and I guess suppose now the presidency of Donald Trump. And just covering the TPP for the past few years, it seems to me that the TPP is a better example of proto-fascism or global fascism, since you will have corporations basically not only controlling this government, but governments around the world. What did you make of the talk about proto-fascism in the election and not really having it connected to the TPP?
That's a really good point. And not just to the TPP, but also not really connected to the way corporations are dominant in our government right now. If you want to take that definition of fascism, you know, that deals with corporate power, really controlling the government, we have much more problems with the Democrats' policies, Republicans as well. Both parties are, you know, bipartisan agreement on corporate power. That's our big challenge. And that's why TPP is so important. This is a classic fight of the people versus corporate power. And we're on the verge of winning it. And so if we win it, we are dealing a blow to that kind of corporate power, that kind of the classic definition of fascism. And so we really hope people come out and join us. There will be a number of events throughout the week. On Monday, we have both a protest during the day, which will be, I think, pretty spectacular, and then one at night, a torch and pitchfork protest, which we hope people will participate in.
You said torch and pitchfork?
Yeah, we actually planned this a while ago, and we have these torches and pitchforks that are made out of L wire, so they light up, and they look pretty interesting. All of our marches are family friendly, so we encourage people to come out, you know, for them and participate. But I want to say that an important lesson that I hope people are taking from this election is that the Democrats lost because they rejected the needs and interests of their base in favor of wealth-dominated politics. This can be placed squarely on the backs of the Democratic Party for rejecting the people.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton really represented the party. I mean, Hillary Clinton had her flaws, but the party has its flaws. And it's a party that favors their donors over their voters. I mean, you saw low turnouts in urban areas in key states because the position of African Americans and Latinos has gotten worse under President Obama. He did nothing for them. They ignored, and these are communities that are in crisis, and they still got no progress. So they stayed home. Women even didn't come out for Hillary Clinton in a big way. And that vote alone could have changed the outcome. They didn't come out because economics hurts them too. The reality is most Americans are not doing well in this economy, and the Democrats put forward policies that sent wealth to the top, and TPP would do that as well. And Obama pushing TPP really undermined her. If you look at the states of Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Indiana, all states that Obama had won in one election or both elections, Indiana won election, and they were lost this time. And the issue was economy. The issue, the foundation of that was trade. And yet Obama's pushing this TPP in the midst of an election.
Exactly.
People reject it.
I thought that was very strange. I was going to ask you if you thought that President Obama pushing for the TPP while Clinton said she was against it after being for it in the first place hurt her. It just seemed, you know, there were like two messages, divergent messages on the same stage at the same time.
It absolutely hurt her, and I don't think anybody believed that her opposition to the TPP was real, and that was revealed in the emails that she basically came out against it in order to appease the labor. But, you know, there were clear signs that she was for it. When we looked at the process of creating the Democratic Party platform, there was an amendment put forth to reject the TPP, to have the Democrats, you know, openly reject the TPP. And Clinton's delegates worked to defeat that. We look at who she put in power. Tim Kaine has been pro-TPP. And look at her transition team, the leadership of that, Ken Salazar, also pro-TPP. Tom Donahue of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said they totally expected Clinton to be pro-TPP. So I think the voters saw through that. And that's an indictment of these policies that the Democrats have put forth, including the health care law, which has not delivered what the people want or need.
Yeah, the healthcare law is another example of corporate power versus people power. People power would have been help expand Medicare to cover everybody, improve it so everyone long better coverage. One thing I wanted to highlight more that Margaret mentioned was that WikiLeaks document that was leaked. It showed Hillary Clinton saying, "I'm opposed to TPP to get labor off my back, and after the election, I'll support the TPP." Her public face, her private face was shown there. And that really undermined her. And so I think if she had taken a much clearer opposition to Obama on TPP, actually passed that plank in the platform that Sanders put forward, and actually worked to stop the lame duck session considering the TPP, it could have been a different outcome.
I noticed that in some of your documents, you credit activists around the world for pushing the TPP fight into this election year and making it politically toxic. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, because there were several stages in the fight when, you know, it looked like the TPP might sail through, and you had to kind of work to keep stopping it so that it would become an election issue.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've been fighting this for the past 5 years, and when we first started, very few people, even in the activist community, knew about it, knew that it existed or what it was. But this was an opportunity, because it impacts really everything that we care about, to build a movement of movements. And so people came from the, you know, GMO labeling movement, the healthcare movement, labor, environment, internet. So many groups came together and fought together. And so for a number of years, the president was pushing Congress to give him something called Fast Track, or Trade Promotion Authority, which would allow him to sign the TPP and other agreements before Congress sees them, and then they get passed through Congress using a very restrictive process that doesn't allow Congress members to make any changes to the agreement. It gives them a brief time to debate it, and then they have to vote up or down. For a number of years, he kept saying, we're going to have fast track this year, we're going to have fast track this year. We kept pushing and pushing, protesting, contacting members of Congress, and we drove that into the spring of 2015, when actually all the negotiations had broken down for the TPP. The other countries weren't willing to proceed, and Obama had to get fast track, and we fought that too. And he really had to twist a lot of arms and get just enough votes to pass it. We were told in 2 years ago by leaders in Congress that voters didn't care about trade, that this was, they didn't understand it, they didn't think it impacted them, it was not an election issue. But when we pushed this into an election year, we saw that that was actually completely false, that voters do care. We've got more than 20 years of experience now with these agreements like NAFTA. We know what they do to our communities, driving a race to the bottom for workers. And so it did become politically toxic to the point where many members of Congress were running away from it leading up to the elections. And so this is because of the work of activists across the country in the United States, and there have been global days of action as well, and very strong actions around the world in other TPP member countries. So this, we are in a good and a strong position. It's not done yet, but this will be a real showing of our power if we succeed, and something that we can build off of, because we know now more than ever that the people are going to have to set the political agenda going forward and not let the political elites do that.
In fact, I think that was true whether Clinton or Trump came in, that the people had to set the agenda. And I think with Trump, that's maybe even more true. We can take the benefits of Trump, which obviously would help to stop the TPP. We can take the benefits of maybe not having a war with Russia, because he wants to have, you know, work with Russia, unlike Clinton, who was very belligerent. So there are some benefits, but we're going to have some challenges too.
Seriously.
Obviously, with Trump on, you know, racism and bigotry and misogyny, and he was going to be appointing to key agencies will escalate the carbon infrastructure and escalate the climate crisis. So we have a lot of challenges, but right now we are on the verge of winning. And the key to winning really was pushing the TPP into an election year. That was the key. Once it got into an election year, and thankfully, you know, Trump and Sanders opposed it, then you had a debate. Because once there's opposition to it in key candidates, then Hillary Clinton is pressured, and she has to change her position. She showed, and that was key. Now it's kind of on the verge of stopping in the lame duck, which is incredible. If we stop in the lame duck, Trump says he's going to withdraw from the TPP on the first day. He wants to renegotiate it completely. And what that means is probably it's dead. Just like the WTO, when the Battle of Seattle and the protests around that stopped the WTO, it has never recovered. They can't reach agreement. They had a very hard time reaching agreement on the TPP with President Obama. Mm-hmm. Trump even tougher. And I think the TPP will not get renegotiated successfully. So this could be the end of it.
I actually have, you mentioned the coalitions and the protests that have happened here and internationally. I actually have a clip of one protester here at a rally, I think last year that we recorded, and her name is Virginia. I'll play her now.
Well, the TPP is not really a trade deal. It's a corporate takeover. It's 5,500 and some pages of baffle gap written in legalese so people don't understand it's money slots for people at the top. And maybe the top 10% will benefit, but the people at the bottom will all get screwed, you know, in various ways. It's bad enough, you know, to watch the wealth inequality and the income inequality grow, but this will just make things so much worse. Right, how can you expect American workers to compete with Vietnamese workers making 65 cents an hour? We're creating a playing field that's so uneven, no one can win, except the people at the top.
So that was one of the protesters out at the rally, I think it was last year, because there's been several rallies. But so one of the things I wanted to ask is about the connections that we can make between the terms of the TPP and what's happening right now with the Dakota Access Pipeline. I know that the rallies for the TPP really galvanized a lot of a huge kind of coalition of people fighting for a lot of different causes, because all of those causes were impacted by the TPP. And I'm wondering about the connection between this, these proposed rules and the Dakota Access Pipeline and those types of pipeline projects.
Yes, thank you. And actually, we will be joining protests this week against the Dakota Access Pipeline in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. But there are direct connections in a couple of ways. One is that the TPP provides kind of a fast-track permitting for export of oil and gas to TPP member countries. So it's going to drive greater drilling for oil and gas to sell it in overseas markets. And another is that if a community or, you know, local or state government tries to interfere in any way with stopping drilling or, you know, getting gas or pipelines or any of that infrastructure, that will be seen as something that interferes with the profits of corporations, and they can then sue those communities in this court, this trade tribunal, which is really, it's a one-way court. It's a court for corporations to sue governments if they pass laws that interfere with profits, but people and governments don't have a right in that court to sue the corporations. And what's really amazing about the court is that the judges are corporate lawyers on leave from their jobs serving as judges, and they have a history, we know now, of siding overwhelmingly in favor of the corporations. So this is going to drive more drilling and prevent us from stopping it by passing laws in our communities.
You know, if Trump stops the TPP, withdraws from that, withdraws from NAFTA, which will be very challenging but can be done, if he does that, that takes away a lot of corporate power. I don't know if he realizes it, but it takes away a lot of corporate power. You know, we're being sued right now by TransCanada over the KXL. The foreign corporation that's behind Dakota could sue over that being blocked if that was stopped. And so that power needs to be taken away. Now, Trump may still negotiate with TransCanada and get the KXL going again. A lot of his advisors profit from these pipelines. A lot of the Koch brothers, are their foundation of their money is carbon infrastructure. So, you know, they have a lot of self-interest to continue to build that. So we have a big challenge. You know, the big challenge also with these is agreements like the Copenhagen Agreement on climate change are not enforceable. They're voluntary. Agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and NAFTA are enforceable. They are not voluntary. And those agreements go against, they stand the opposite of what the Copenhagen...
The Paris,
I'm sorry, I'm living in the past. The Paris Agreement, has set. It is the opposite of goals. And so we really have a problem with these trade agreements. We can do good, that's the next key thing. What would good trade look like? Good trade would look like using trade to achieve the Paris Accord goals. Good trade would look like raising labor standards around the world. Good trade would reverse environmental degradation, improve food safety. We can do all these things through trade. It doesn't have to be bad. So I think one of our tasks now that we're defeating the TPP, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves on that, but once we defeat the TPP, is putting forward what our vision of trade is. What is trade that protects people and planet? How is it negotiated in a transparent way so people know what's going on? That's the goals. We need to create a new framework. These kinds of trade agreements don't work. When they pass, it's by one or two votes. When they fail, which is often, it's because they're so unpopular. We can create trade that is actually popular and actually achieves positive ends for people and planet, and that's what our task is next.
Okay. I've been speaking with the co-directors of Popular Resistance, an organization for social justice and activism and news, Kevin Zeeson, Margaret Flowers. Now, before I let you go, remind people how they can connect with your action that starts tomorrow.
Thank you so much. We're starting a training camp tomorrow night, and then on Monday we begin the actions, 4 days of actions. The information is on our website. It's both on popularresistance.org. You'll see it in the top banner, or you can also find it on flushthetpp.org if you look under the actions section.
But for folks who aren't web a lot, where do they go to the first demonstration if they're not on the web?
Sorry. So there's one Monday morning at 11 a.m. We meet at Freedom Plaza at the corner of 14th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. And then that's at 11 a.m. And then in the evening at 5:30 p.m., we'll be meeting outside of the Capitol Visitors Center at First Street and East Capitol Street Northeast.
Okay.
Across from the Supreme Court.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Esther.
Okay. So when we come back, we're going to talk about whether Trump's election has emboldened the so-called alt-right. Stay with us.
Now, meanwhile, if Trump, I'm telling you, man, think about this for 1 second. It's Trump versus Hillary Clinton. Trump's going to say, he's both. Soros gave her $6 million.
Yes.
All these guys, all the big banks.
Yes.
I'm the populist.
He's going to like take Bernie's argument and adopt it into his own twisted Voldemort idea.
And add racism and actual misogyny.
And so now Hillary Clinton might be able to withstand that. Because there's a lot of people who hate Trump and so over the top.
Some people say that he's guilty, that he's guilty. Some people say, I don't know. Some people say, give him a chance. Oh, some people say, wait until he's convicted. Read the president. Read the president. Read the president. Read the president.
That was another post-election remix from DJ Waheed on The Ground, ontheground.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Avarim, and I'm joined now by Andrew Batcher. Andrew Batcher is a D.C. organizer who has worked in the anti-war movement, the Occupy movement, and is doing white solidarity work with the Black Lives Matter movement. He helped to start the D.C. Learning Collective and the D.C. Free School and is currently organizing as part of the D.C. Anti-Fascist Coalition. That coalition will be holding a protest this week on Saturday, November 19th at 12:30 p.m. right outside the Ronald Reagan Building at Pennsylvania Avenue and 13th Street Northwest. They're protesting the National Policy Institute, which is a self-described white nationalist think tank. NPI is part of the so-called alt-right, which has been enthused by Trump's presidency and have been identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. NPI's long-term vision includes a whites-only ethno-state, which they wish to create via peaceful ethnic cleansing, and that's in quotes, and forced sterilization. They come to D.C. to hold conferences in the Ronald Reagan Building, which is a government building, in order to gain respectability for their movement. And Trump has helped to give NPI and other hate groups an opening into mainstream politics. Wow, Andrew, that's quite. Now, we were out there last, was it
March.
Earlier this year? March?
In March.
And so why are they back here again? And what's new with the NPI now? Why are they back here?
Well, I mean, I think they're back here for the same reason they were here before, which is to gain respectability for the movement. Trump's campaign has really launched. First of all, no one had heard about the alt-right before the campaign, and they were kind of a fringe movement, largely online on 4chan and Reddit, and doing kind of harassing on social media. They were involved in the Gamergate scandal, which was some feminists criticized misogyny, sexism within video games, and there was a huge backlash from right-wing fringe elements, a rising tide. Also, there was harassment of Leslie Jones, who was the actress in the new Ghostbusters remake, the black actress in the Ghostbusters remake. There were a lot of racist tweets that went her way, organized amongst the alt-right.
So these are the people who, like, whenever you, like, if you go to YouTube and you see, like, someone's put up a totally innocuous video about, like, black life or something, you'll see, like, if they allow comments, you'll see this barrage of racists. Mm-hmm. That's the alt-right. They're trolls. They're trolls.
Yes. That's part. But I think they're also wanting to, you know, move off of online and more into the mainstream. And, you know, also you've probably heard of things like Trump retweeting things from Stop White Genocide. That's an alt-right name right there, this idea that the white person, the white man, because it's very patriarchal too, that the white man is under attack, mm-hmm. And that they need to kind of reclaim. Very anti-immigrant, you know, and you saw Trump really speaking to that, calling Mexicans criminals and rapists, build a wall, that whole chant. The violence that occurred in Trump rallies, mm-hmm. people connected with the alt-right
right.
as well. Like Matthew Heimbach, who there was a video of him pushing the black woman protester, Black Lives Matter protester, who was at a Trump rally.
Who is Matthew Heimbach?
Matthew Heimbach is the founder of the Traditional Workers Party, also of the White Student Union.
Where is he based?
And sometimes he's called, Towson, Maryland, mm-hmm. and sometimes he's called, at least he was with the White Student Union. He gets around, sometimes he's been called also the sort of new generation of David Duke, because mm-hmm. he's kind of has political aspirations.
Okay. So give me some sense of the landscape of the alt-right. We know that even the term was coined by the head of this
Richard Spencer, the head of the National Policy Institute.
And also we've heard the term used in connection with the Trump campaign because Steve Bannon, who was formed Breitbart News, was a...
He was in charge of... He didn't form it, but he ran it.
Who ran Breitbart News was a big part of the Trump campaign in terms mm-hmm. of the messaging and a lot of the way the messages would roll out.
Yeah.
So give us kind of a sense of the landscape of that world and where the National Policy Institute fits into it.
Yeah, so Richard Spencer, who's the head of the National Policy Institute, has actually called Steve Bannon alt-light. So it's sort of the Steve Bannon and Breitbart sort of represents a more mainstream version of alt-right, where they'll be less overtly racist. So less saying, you know, we need a white homeland, and more saying, hey, publicizing the birther movement, for example, saying, you know, I don't know, is Obama really an American? You know, is he a secret Muslim? Like this kind of thing, where it's a little less overt, but still very much propels the goals of the movement, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so is it just those two groups? I'm just in terms of the landscape. We've already talked about this kind of like lurking, like online cadre of people, and we've talked about the National Policy Institute, and we know about Breitbart. Is that the extent of it? Or?
No. So the alt-right also has relationships with other right-wing groups. They distinguish themselves from mainstream conservatism by being explicit about race, essentially, that they're explicitly racist.
Mm-hmm.
They also distinguish themselves from, like, the KKK and the Nazi Party by trying to be lower-key and more respectable. So you see this in the name.
They don't have the hood.
Yeah.
They don't have the hood. They don't have the swastika.
They put their hoods and swastikas away. Yeah, mm-hmm. they hide that stuff. But there's a lot in common in the ideology.
Who funds, where do these people get their money?
I know that the name is escaping me right now. But I do know that William Regnery, that's right, is a funder for the National Policy Institute, and he's a publishing magnate.
Okay.
I'm not sure the whole extent of where the funding comes from, but, I mean, they have enough funding to host swanky events in D.C. in the Reagan building, and, yeah.
And I know we talked about this earlier this year in March, but for the listeners who may be listening and, like, totally, like, outraged or like wondering, how can they rent the Reagan building? Can any of us rent it and we just don't know that? Or most of us in the progressive community, we don't have that kind of money. Yeah. But how do they have access to a federally funded building?
Yeah, so in March we did a call-in campaign with the Reagan building, asking them to informing them first of all that this was a hate group,
And a hate group as described by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Their argument was that that they had rented the space before, that they had proven to be that they could use the space. Basically, I think that means they didn't mess with the furniture. And that freedom of speech, basically, they said that they could meet for that reason. In the past, similar groups like the American Renaissance is kind of another is a very similar group to NPI. Had conferences in hotels, and actually activists informed the hotels about who these groups were, and they got those conferences canceled. But there's this idea that they can actually hide more within the government building.
Yeah. Right, and the federal government has an obligation to enforce the First Amendment provisions or whatever.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, they have an obligation to enforce the First Amendment, but it's renting of a space. And we say you can't cry fire in a burning theater. I mean, I honestly think that calling Mexicans rapists and criminals is like yelling fire in a burning theater. I mean, mm-hmm. it's rallying people to oppress.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just going to, we have some sound from the rally in March, and I want to play that now.
No racist, no KKK, no fascist USA, no racist, no KKK,
no fascist USA,
no racist, no KKK,
no fascist USA.
This is not the first time the NPI has felt like they could create a safe space, that there's an opening for this kind of fascist venom and bile. That's not, in fact, with a candidate like Donald Trump, that's like opening doors for groups like the NPI. You know, I think we should be on guard.
NPI, no damn good. You should wear a sheet and hood. NPI, no damn good. You should wear a sheet and hood.
From your March rally. And just this morning, I heard about several incidents, just like hate incidents, you know, violence, harassment. And is this the type of thing that, how does your organization kind of react to these developments? Is these the kinds of things that you're concerned about?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, you talked earlier about some of the elements of fascism, corporate takeover. Another major element is the suspension of human rights and kind of the preservation of social order through violence. And that violence can be both state and by people who are emboldened. Mm-hmm. But I think we're at a time right now when we have to be very watchful and very active. There's the quote from Martin Niemöller about first they came for the socialists and I didn't speak out against them because I wasn't one, and then they came for the Jews and I didn't speak out, and then there's no one, then they came for me and there was no one there to speak out for me.
Right.
I think that this is a call to really get out there right now to show our value about the world that we believe in, the society, the not racist, not sexist, not ableist, classist, oppressive, the real liberating free society that we believe in. It's time to act and be very bold about that.
Okay. Now, we know, we've talked a little bit about the alt-right and the Trump's campaign, and groups like this, like the NPI, obviously emboldened by his campaign. But how about the alt-right figures that look to be perhaps heading into the White House? What do you know about that?
Yeah, so I'm glad that you mentioned that. So I think we talked a minute ago about Rudy Giuliani before we started here, and you know, he's been a very vocal supporter of stop and frisk, and I mentioned the suspension of human rights. Trump has also talked about being a law and order candidate, and these are code words for racial profiling. And in light of like the Black Lives Matter movement too, I think there's a lot to worry about crackdowns.
Actually, Giuliani said that that's going to be the first group investigated or
that's
something.
That's terrible.
For terrorism?
Oh my God. Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So people like Giuliani, obviously, people like to, apparently he is being considered for attorney general or something.
That's right.
That's one news report. I don't know how true it is, but wow. Okay. All right. So your action is next Saturday, November 19th at 12:30 p.m. right outside the Ronald Reagan Building at Pennsylvania Avenue and 13th Street.
Yes.
All right. So hopefully we can be out there and see what's happening and provide some coverage again.
Thank you very much, Esther. We'd love to have you there.
Yeah. All right. So that will do it for us on the ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. A special thanks to all my guests, Gerald Horn, Margaret Flowers, Kevin Zeeson, Andrew Batcher. Thanks to Chantel James, Michael Byfield, and Floyd DJ Waheed Aaron for their contribution to today's show. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella, and thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Averam. Stay tuned for Community Watch and Comment. Raise your voice out there. Peace.